Live from the Funky Pirate, the swankiest drinking hole on Bourbon Street, and brought to you by Travelocity, home of the roaming gnome. You'll never roam alone. Travelocity.com. I'm Delmon.
And I'm Alicious.
And this is EQ2 Talk. This is episode number 17, and we are recording on February 12th, 2011. And Allie, why don't we have theme music?
Well, I've been locked in the Festering Hag's cage all week where you left me, and I just got out.
Well, I don't have time right now to hear more of your excuses. We have a very important and special guest joining us this week. So let's have him join us right now, shall we?
Yeah.
So let's introduce Carlos Ninja Mora, EQ2 Hello. Developer.
Before we get started, do you prefer to be called Carlos or Ninja?
Either one's fine with me.
You know who else is named Carlos in real life? Another famous person? Chuck Norris?
No.
Chuck Norris.
Oh, there's several. Yeah, technically.
Do you see a lot of similarities between Ninja and Chuck Norris, Allie?
Martial arts?
I wish.
So, Carlos, where does the ninja handle come from?
Oh, man. Well, it actually started out as a joke back in the original EverQuest. My friends wanted me to play a tank and told me I had to play an ogre because they were the only good tanks, according to them. So I asked, you know, what the worst one was, and they responded as gnome. So, you know, me being the funny man I am, decided to play a gnome tank and couldn't come up with a name, so I decided to keep with the humorous theme and just call him Ninja and then put a G in front of it because of the silent G in gnome. Even though I've kind of moved on and used tons of different names since then, all my friends still call me Ninja, and it kind of just stuck.
Now, as you know, I have a bad habit of butchering names, so it's Ninja, not Gunninja, right?
Right. No matter how much everyone else at SOE tries to convince you, it is Ninja.
And your avatar on the forums, it's Beaver Cleaver, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
Where does that come from?
That was a joke by another coworker. It's actually our old producer, Brenlo. He said it would be funny to change my avatar on a whim and try to, you know, get me to not like it or, you know, just kind of be funny and I actually kind of liked the look that it had and decided to keep it and go with it. So, yeah, kind of backfired on him a little bit.
So, how did you get started with EQ2 as a developer, and how long have you been with the team?
Oh, man. I've been a huge fan of the game forever. I mean, ever since, you know, beta. I played EQ1 for a long time, you know, right as it came out, I joined. Played it pretty religiously. Started making some in-game movies for IGN. While I was a computer programmer in the military. And when my tour was up, I had to figure out what I wanted to do, and the IGN thing was a ton of fun. So I got to create things and figured it would be kind of cool to kind of steer my life in this direction. So started working towards it, started, you know, getting to know people and getting to know everything that was involved with game design, and eventually got my chance and jumped at it. I'm loving it ever since.
Very, very cool. Can you give us a little bit of an overview of what all you do at SOE?
Well, primarily I work on content, and that's content in every fashion of the game. I've worked on just about every form of content. More recently, I've been doing zones for the expansion and live events, quests, that type thing. Pretty much anything that has to do with what goes into the game, I've probably worked with.
You were mentioning a moment ago that you started out as a gnome warrior. Are you still preferential to the fighter classes?
No, I do still play my gnome guardian, which I created just kind of keep with the theme. He is max level, But I play him more to kind of just hang out and talk to people because he gets bombarded with tells pretty much the moment he logs in. But I've been leaning a little bit more toward the scout class here recently. Just I like the fast pace and the damage that they can deal and stuff. But I do like both classes.
I'm smiling inside.
Well, truth be told, is it an assassin?
It is not.
So it's a ranger?
I actually play a dirge.
Oh, okay.
Yes, there are other classes besides ranger and assassin that are scouts.
Really? What drew you most to the dirge?
To be honest, and I really wasn't all that interested in playing a dirge at first, but the raiding force that I was with at the time really needed a dirge, and we kept gaining a dirge, and then they'd leave a couple weeks later, and then we'd gain a dirge, and they'd leave a couple weeks later, and that was one of the classes that we really needed to keep. So we were a bit heavy on clerics at the time. I was playing an Inquisitor. So I offered to level one of my little alt dirges that I had had for a while and leveled him up pretty quick and got him equipped up and ended up loving the class.
It's kind of funny that you say that you know, you necessarily didn't start out to play it, but it kind of grew on you over time.
Oh, yeah. It definitely did.
So what are some of the things that you've been working on the content side of the house that folks might recognize in game as your handiwork?
Oh, well, I mean, the most recognizable pieces would probably be the Haunted Hedge Maze or the Haunted Mansion in Somborn. Those are probably the two pieces that people talk to me about the most when they're like, oh, you're Ninja, and oh, did you do the Haunted the Hedge Maze and stuff? And we really love that, you know, so that's probably the one thing that I get talked to about most.
So that was from Knights of the Dead?
Yes.
Now, you also did Outer Vault at 1.2, right?
I did, yes.
I have to say that is one of my favorite zones.
Oh, well, thank you.
Because of the story that goes along with it and the recognizable NPCs that you meet along the way.
you recognize them a little bit?
A little bit. And I think it's a very interesting story because you kind of start out as a group of six adventurers, and then you kind of form into this group of 12 adventurers rescuing these folks along the way, and then they help you in the fight at the end to accomplish the mission of the zone.
I had a lot of fun making that zone. I really did.
Although, I have to be honest, I always get stuck, and I say that, but I won't admit who. I always get stuck with the same person every time we go in there.
The different adventures that you can get throughout there, they're kind of geared towards certain classes. I mean, the tank is typically wanting to get the tank, although I've seen some take the Templar. Most of the time they take the tank for the damage reduction and stuff like that. But I tried to make it fitting, you know, when your mage classes are probably going to be more likely to get the mage, or not mage, but the conjurer, whereas the scout will probably get the brigand, that type of thing.
But it is niceable because that zone is doable in a lot of different configurations. It's not like
Yes. Your
tank must take the tank.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, there's even extra rewards if you can manage to do it without using all the pets.
Oh, really?
Yes. There's. I put a little Easter egg, I guess you could say, in there. If you can manage to do it with only two of the pets and kill the last boss, he'll guarantee to drop Fabled.
All right, Ellie, you know what we're doing on Monday night now.
But you still have to figure out which two to use, and it's not an easy fight without those pets. Trust me.
Oh, so it's a combination of only of the six, you only take a particular two to succeed?
Correct. Your best bet is to look at the boss and figure out, you know, what each pet does to the boss, you know, if they're not present. And there are two pets that you absolutely need to have, or something bad will happen, and it'll just keep getting worse. The other pets are kind of just, oh, he'll get an extra AoE, or he'll summon, or, you know, that type of stuff. So if you can work through all those extra things that he can do without the pets, then you get a little extra reward. There's two very unique items that drop off in that configuration. But you also get the loot from the regular chest as well. So you'll get the loot plus a bonus Fabled.
I think I've only been through there once, maybe. I want to go back.
Yeah, I did all three of the whole dungeons last expansion.
Oh, very cool.
Oh, so, very cool.
Yeah, so what's it, Demetrius Bastion and...
Spirit's Resonance. Yeah.
Spirit's Reconnaissance, right. The one that I always get teased about because I can't say it correctly, so I always say Reconnaissance.
Reconnaissance is harder to say than Resonance.
I actually had a lot of fun making the boss in that one too. I was trying to go a little bit unique with it and do something that hasn't been done before, and it created a lot of bugs, and it took me a while to get it right, but once it was right, I think it turned out to be pretty fun.
So what are some of the other things that you're most proud of that you've put in game?
Oh, most proud of? Wow, that's a really tough question. I'm proud of everything I've done. I mean, I can't say that everything was perfect. You know, there's always things that could have been done better or could have been, you know, better implemented or done a different way. But I'm pretty proud of everything I've done. I put a lot of heart and soul into what I do. So I try to get it as near as what I would consider fun as I can get it.
So if there was one thing that you could say go back and do differently, what would it be?
Oh, go back and do differently? Probably would have had less caffeine this morning. No. There's not much that I would go back and change. I mean, there's some things that didn't turn out, you know, exactly the way I wanted them. A good example might be like the Icy Keep raid zone. I loved that zone. I put a lot of work into it. But it just didn't quite work out for the timing of when it came out. I think if it would have been released at a different time or maybe with the expansion or something, I think it would have been better received, or maybe making it a times two instead of a times four. But yeah, done a lot of things to try to make it better over time, to kind of, you know, ease the frustrations, I guess you could say, of that zone. But it's still pretty painful.
I actually enjoyed that zone a lot because I thought a lot of the encounters were different. They weren't the typical drag the mob into the corner, DPS, and then loot chest.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. That's definitely what I was aiming for. I was actually trying to make a zone that maybe some of the casual guilds could actually go in there and be challenged, but at the same time be able to work on it, you know, more than just, you know, going in there for an hour, clearing it and leave. I made it a bit long on purpose. I figured, you know, people would break it up over, you know, a couple days of the week or something like that, but players didn't really respond to that very well. They like being able to go in and clear it and be done with it. So that's probably, I might have made it into two parts or made it a little easier or something, just to kind of make it a little easier to complete in one run. There's a lot of quests in there too that I did, which we typically don't do. Mm-hmm. Typically don't put many quests in raid zones, but we had an apprentice that was on the team, Cindy Bateman. She did a lot of the quests in that zone, and I kind of oversaw it, and they turned out good, and they turned out the way I wanted them. But since you have to go back so many times to complete a lot of them, a lot of players didn't really respond well to that.
Well, that's unfortunate, because I really feel like that is a really good reason to get people to drive people back to the zone. That's one of the reasons why our raid force, it's kind of split. There are those of us who want to keep going back because we want to get the quests. and then there are other people who want to do other things. So it's, I can see how that would be
challenge. Also, you doing the quests that require you to go back a couple times, we were able to make some of the loot that came from those quests a little bit better than they would have been, because they required a little bit more effort. So, we were able to do that. Not as many people liked it as I thought it would. I mean, it was popular with a certain, there was some things I could have done differently, but it's all a learning experience.
So jumping ahead a little bit to the upcoming expansion, players have been talking about Velias for at least a couple of years now. People are getting kind of chomping at the bit a little bit. How much pressure does the team feel right now, 1 week before launch?
There's a lot of pressure. I mean, there's a lot of pressure before every launch of an expansion, just because, you know, we're all very, you know, kind of chomping at the bit to hope people really enjoy the content that we're making and the new mechanics and stuff. But there's probably a little bit more pressure this time than before, because, I mean, Velios was such an awesome expansion in EQ1. So it's definitely a little bit more pressure, but I think we're going to surprise some people.
You're absolutely right. Scars of Velius was definitely an iconic expansion from EverQuest 1, and that's actually when I first got introduced to EverQuest, was when Scars of Velius went live. So what were some of the iconic parts and really special things about Scars of Velius that you and the rest of the team wanted to make sure that you brought forward into Destiny of Velius?
Well, I mean, when we first sat down and discussed it, there was a few that jumped out right away. That we wanted to make sure, you know, we didn't leave out of the expansion. Tower of Frozen Shadow, Durgadin, Kale, Velks, a couple other little things. We didn't want to really do a complete copy of the original Velios either, though. you know, we want to kind of put our own little spin on it. And we had 500 years between that Velios and this Velios to kind of tell what's changed and stuff.
So how do you balance that? How do you balance being true to the original SOV, yet spin your version of DOV?
I mean, if players wanted to play the original Velios, they would just go back and play the original Velios. So that wouldn't be why they were in EQ2. So we wanted to make sure that you know, we have a ton of things that we have in our game that are unique, or that we've done really well with systems such as, you know, like the housing items and, you know, cool scripted events, the raids that we have, those type of things, that we feel that we could take what was there originally and keep a little bit of that nostalgia, but at the same time make it EQ2. Now, we have to sacrifice a little bit of nostalgia for that, and I think most players actually understand that, but for the most part, we just try not to recreate Velios in the same way it was. I mean, if we were to do that, then, you know, you'd be going through the expansion being like, oh, well, you know, we know exactly what to do because, you know, we played this before. Now, not all players will get that, but, you know, at least the ones that played the original EverQuest would. And we didn't want to step on that. We don't want to try to fill those shoes, I guess you could say.
Sure, that's very true. You don't want to, I guess, make a bit-for-bit replica of it just with cooler graphics.
Right.
It has to still be unique but rememberable. From what I do remember from the original release, or the original EverQuest 1 version of it, and sure, and with the spin of what the mechanics and all that we have today, and what 500 years of history have done to it.
Yeah, it's a tough balance. I mean, while we don't want to leave the nostalgia out, because, you know, and even I would be upset if I went into Velios and it was completely different than I remember. I mean, you'd want some sense of nostalgia there, but at the same time, you don't want to make it to where a player that doesn't know anything about Velios goes in and they're completely lost because they don't know the backstory. So we try to make it a good mix. And in the places where we do use nostalgia, we try not to choke you with nostalgia. We try to, you know, at least tell a little bit of the backstory so you can kind of get where we're coming from and then pick up the story.
So why are we finding Velios now? What's going on in game with the lore and the storyline that has driven us to find the continent of Velios again?
Well, have you been following the live events that have gone on, the few little tidbits that we've kind of put out there so far?
I have been, but let's just say Allie hasn't been.
Okay. Well, the first big thing that kind of happened was Latazal showed up all of a sudden at the end of the little prelude events that we had with Alcabor and D'Artain, or Darkabor, as we've been calling him. So what happened at the end of Otis was, you know, you had Carafrim. He kind of tricked the players into defeating the boss in the void. For some reason, his name just totally skips my mind.
Rowanthir,
there we go. Sorry about that.
No problem.
So he tricks the players into going after Rowanthir because Rowanthir has this horrible power where he can just, you know, kill the gods and bring, you know, devastation to the world. But what you come to find out is that Carafrim just wanted the power for himself. So once the players weakened him, and I mean, this is a bit of a spoiler for Sentinel's Fate, if for those of you that haven't actually seen that, but once you actually defeat Rowanthir at the end, Carafrim does actually show up, and he drains the power out of his two swords, out of Rowanthir's two swords. And all of a sudden, now Carafrim has the power to slay gods, which is a bad thing. So, and then he retreats. And so we kind of picking up the story from there. I don't want to give away too much with the story in Velios, but the Ocean Lord, Praxis, basically had given power to Latazal to be kind of his messenger, I guess you could say. And Latazal, being this massive turtle, can't communicate with the adventurers of Norrath. So he uses an Othmir named Nippik, which, I don't know if you guys have read this story. It's out on the EQ2 players right now. But he speaks through him and finds out that he needs to go to Norrath, get the adventurers, and bring him to Velios to, so they can become part of this story and take their place. But, I mean, the rest you'll have to see when the expansion comes out. Cause it's a pretty cool story, and it's not over by any means. It gets cooler. You get a couple other notable names get thrown in there along the way, and it gets pretty cool.
So what are some of the aspects of Destiny of Veilius that you have been working on, just generally speaking?
Well, it's interesting, actually, because I get to talk about it since the NDA's lifted. I actually worked on Tower of Frozen Shadow. I worked on all the three instances there and the raid, well, times two raid. And I also worked on the Velkator's Labyrinth set. I also actually did some quests in Great Divide involving the pirate gnomes.
In the process of making this expansion, have you had any moments of total elation or total frustration that you can share with us?
I have to think about that. Well, I mean, with every project, there comes a point where you hit a brick wall in what you're doing. So I've had a lot of frustration points. Not frustration in the part of, oh my God, I wish I shouldn't have done this, but just, you know, I try to put something new into the dungeons that I create, something that, you know, players might not necessarily have seen before. They haven't seen it a certain way, that type of thing. And that's really where the frustrations come from, because if you're doing something new, it hasn't necessarily been figured out yet on how exactly to do it. So it gets kind of tough. I don't want to go into too much detail on what those new things are, you know, because I want it to be a surprise when players see it for the first time. But I can give one example. The Ascent, or the Hold of Rhyme, the Ascent, it's the second zone in the Velkator's Labyrinth dungeon set. It's pretty neat. You go through it, you know, it seems like it's just a normal zone. You go through it, you kill a couple bosses, you get to the end, and you replace a shard of Vishan's Claw that was found into a receptacle at the end of the zone. And it really feels like, you know, a cool ending, you know, to the zone, because, you know, the lights go off and everything looks like it's all starting to grow back and everything, because the Vishan's Claw brings life to the whatever it touches. But all of a sudden, when you replace it, you turn around and the entire zone has changed. Everything's starting to come to life, and, you know, things are kind of, you know, completely different. I mean, one thing that was completely frozen over is now growing like a giant vine, or, you know, stuff like that. It's pretty neat. Just doing stuff that is completely outside the box, completely not seen before in our game. And I tried to do that in a couple different places, but that one was especially pretty impressive.
That sounds very exciting. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, it's things like that, I think, that are very exciting that you necessarily aren't expecting. You think, like, you're suggesting the players think maybe the zone is over and you're done, and things start changing around you.
Right. Well, come to find out there's, like, two or three more bosses, and you have to fight all the way back to the beginning, and the beginning of the zone becomes, like, the boss event.
Yeah,
it's pretty neat.
Yeah, I have to say, one of the things I find most enjoyable, too, is when I feel that I, as a player, am affecting the world. You know, the MMO, the Norrath, is this living environment, and my actions are making changes in it.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's another thing that I've been really trying to do as much as I can. Another one of the Velkator zones, and this is not really a unique thing, but it's something that I tried to do to kind of keep with that same theme, was that, you know, when you go through it's not new that we've, you know, used a heroic zone and then used it for a raid zone later. But typically, when you go into one of those heroic zones, you go in there, you do the heroic zone, you kill the boss, you leave, and you're like, oh, that was cool. Then you come back in the raid zone, it's completely different. Same geometry, just, you know, completely different bosses. No real, you know, reason or rhyme to what's going on. So what I tried to do with the last zone in the Velkator's set was, you know, I tried to really make it, there's a reason you're going in there as a raid, and that's because of the things you did in the heroic, not necessarily because...
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily because you just need to go in there and kill the bad guy. It's you know, when you go in the heroic version, the epic versions are there. You get to interact with them. You probably can't take them, but you see them there, and you have to more kind of, you know, skirt around them and find ways to distract them, that type of stuff, in order to beat the zone.
Very cool.
So what do you think will be the best part of the DOV expansion?
The best?
Yes, your most favorite part.
Oh, man. Well, the flying mounts are awesome. I can't get enough of them. Even when I was in beta, just running on my, you know, GM character or whatever, helping people, you know, get into zones and stuff, I couldn't help but just jumping on the flying mount and just kind of flying all over the place. And, you know, it's really cool. It's a lot cooler than I've seen in some games where they have flying. It's actually kind of neat.
So with every expansion, we know there will be a lot of new quests. And earlier you had sort of hinted at the Footsteps of D'Artagnan signature line. Will there be longer, more involved quests, heritage quest signatures along the lines, more along the lines of an everlasting gobstopper, not so much like a box of Junior Mints that we want to gobble up all at once?
Well, we definitely wanted to make the signature line very cool and impressive. And yes, there is a signature line. There's actually a couple different hallmarks as well. Most of the hallmarks deal with taking you through the story of each, you know, dungeon set or whatever, or, you know, really unique quest line in the Overland or whatever. But we also have four heritage quests. Each one of those are pretty involved. They're not just, hey, go kill this, go kill this, okay, you're done. They're pretty involved, and they require a little bit of figuring them out, I guess you could say. Another good one is, you know, one I could probably mention a little bit about is the 10th Kuldane Ring. It is back. There are 10 quests, and it is progressive in difficulty, and the end reward might actually maze you a little bit.
Mmm.
Along with the event that goes along with it.
Sounds very exciting. Del and I are both big questers, and we've heard about these new things, public quests. Can mm-hmm. you tell us what they are? Maybe explain a little about how they work? Or is this going to be more of a surprise type of thing?
We can talk a little bit about it. I mean, the public quests, they've been done in a couple games already. And this is really the first time we've really taken a stab at it in EQ2. One of our newer designers, Windslasher, has been working his butt off on them. And they really turned out to be a really good addition to the game. To go into a little bit of the way they work... It's either like an event or battle or something going on that when you enter the area, you can choose to take part of it or not. Typically, when you enter the area, you know, a little quest will pop up, and they don't count towards your max quest, so don't be worried about that. But quest will pop up, and it'll give you, you know, something to do. That quest is shared with everybody who's really doing the quest, and it kind of progresses in unison with everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be grouped up. If you don't want to, you can group up to take advantage of buffs and stuff like that if you like, but you don't necessarily have to be grouped. They range in anything from, you know, giant ring events that end with a real big nasty beastie that you have to kill, or just repelling forces of an invading army or something like that. One thing you probably mentioned is the encounters don't break like they normally would, so you can have multiple groups on the same encounter, and they won't... You know, they won't lock to a certain group or anything like that. Everybody can work together. And the loot that comes from it is all itemized based on the difficulty of how far you got. So you can take one or two people and go and do the public quest and finish it. And when you finish, it'll drop a chest, and everybody who took part will be able to get the loot from that chest. The items that you would have gotten for it would be dependent on how difficult the public quests had achieved, and mm-hmm. the better you do at them, the more the difficulty bar starts to raise, and it can raise pretty darn high.
So will these like reoccur at a regular interval, or?
Yes, they do. I'm not sure the final timer on it, on how quickly they go off, but they do go off semi-quickly. Yeah, they go off fairly often. I'm right. Not sure if it's dependent on how far the last one got or not. I'd have to check with Windslasher, but I know they do go off fairly often.
Sure, so if you missed out on one, if you hung around theoretically long enough, another one would be kicking off. So there's always the opportunity to get in one. It's not, it's happening this day, and we won't see it again for another month or two or something like that.
Oh, no. No, they go off fairly often.
Well, to me, I think these sound very exciting. I remember from Velius originally there was a couple of encounters where the dwarves were engaging the snow orcs, and they would set up and they would start doing battle, and you would join in, or you would help storm the Rygor Ford, or again in the Kuldane Ring, the fight out front of the Thurigan. Those were like epic encounters, and even though they're not necessarily raids per se back then, I don't know if really raids were still the dynamic that they are today, but large people getting involved and working together for a common cause and kind of, again, affecting the outcome of the lands of Velius.
Right.
I always remember my very first 10th ring war. It was very exciting and very nerve-wracking because it was one person trying to get his ring, and nobody wanted to let him down, and everybody was doing their best and fighting as hard as they could, and those giants, they just never stopped coming.
Yeah, you'll definitely get a sense of that as well. We've got the ring war is one of our club public quests, so you'll get to reimagine what happened and actually see what the outcome was after the ring war for me from original EverQuest.
Yeah, if I remember correctly too, if we failed, and I think we did on occasion fail the ring war, the giants storm through the Cauldane City and wipe them all out, don't they?
Yep, they sure did. I remember on several occasions where I needed to get a quest update or something in EverQuest 1, and I'd go into Thurgoden, and there all the dwarves were laying on the ground dead. Of course, everybody shouting through the zone, "All right, who failed?"
Well, nobody would want to ever admit that they failed. But, you know, I guess, you know, that kind of, for lack of better terms, hardcore concept of if you fail, you wipe out a whole city. kind of traumatic. It kind of does, you know, block other players from getting into content and stuff, because like you say, you went into the city and they were all dead, so you can't interact with any of them. But there were ramifications for what we did or didn't do. And that's, again, part of that affecting the world of Norrath.
Absolutely.
So shifting gears a little bit, I wanted to ask you about what type of things we can expect from raid zones in Velias in terms of encounter mechanics. If you had to compare to, say, Vishan's Peak encounters, which involved a lot of movement and positioning, or would they be more like TSO encounters, which involved a lot of curing effects, or more like maybe like Sentinel's Fate, which kind of were all of the above and then some? Will we be seeing something completely different and new, or a combination of the mechanics that we've already seen?
Well, while I can't really go into too much detail on all the quests raids, because I haven't really been too much of a part on making those, I did make the times two, so I can tell you how I was going for that. I know that before I get into the times two, I know that Roger Uzun, the same guy that made the Sentinel's Fate raids and many raids before that, he's trying to stick to the same things that we saw a lot of in Sentinel's Fate and that were very popular, but at the same time, he has his own little bag of tricks for stuff that he'll do that are unique to Velias. As far as the times two, I really tried to make the times two more of a fun and challenging zone rather than being just, you know, the typical, you know, you have to do this or you fail, or you have to do this or something bad happens. I tried to stick to more of engaging a little bit of the story into it. So they're a little bit more event-driven, at the same time not frustrating. Or if they are frustrating, you know, I've been trying to change that and make them a little bit more on the fun side. They're not a walk in the park by any means. It's definitely a little bit more engaging and see a little bit more unique things in it.
It's funny that you call them bags of tricks. I call them absolute hair puller outers. I know I was 19 meters away from that mob. That AE should not have hit me.
Joust? No.
Yeah.
Jousting is for the weak and rangers.
Hey, I don't need to joust.
Let me ask you, though, and this is something I've always wondered about. When you guys are designing encounters, say it be a heroic one or an epic one, how do you know how many hit points to give a mob or how much damage an AE should do or how far it should go? Given all the classes and all the combinations of things that we have, how do you figure out just what is a good encounter when you're building it from a technical point of view?
Well, I mean, we start out with just an idea. I mean, you know, we try to think in our head of, you know, what would be a fun event? What would be a fun encounter to do? And we just kind of try to build that. We don't really worry too much about the hit points or how hard they hit or stuff like that at the beginning. That's more, you know, comes when we try to balance it. We start with just trying to make sure that functionally the encounter works and then go from there. Once we get to the actual balancing side of it, we have to kind of take a lot of different things into consideration. We have to take, you know, the difficulty that the zone is supposed to be, the type of gear that players are going to be expected to have to be in that zone, and kind of gauge that from there. It's a little bit different than you know, making an event for, say, like a live event, like the Headless Horseman, for example. The Headless Horseman, you know, it was kind of a walk in the park for most people because we kind of had to take it and look at it and be like, okay, well, we can't make this so hard that nobody can do it. But at the same time, you know, we have to find a way to make it to where if people try to make it so easy, they can just, you know, kind of hit auto attack AFK, go get a drink and come back and collect their loot. You know, we have to be careful with that. With the zone like, you know, Towerfoot and Shadow, it's a lot easier to balance things, whereas, you know, a live event is a lot harder.
That's interesting. I almost would have thought it would have been the other way around.
No. The Headless Horseman is a good example because when the first year we put it out, I had scripted it just as being, you know, hey, you need to kind of position him in the correct places or else he, you know, kind of goes nuts and you know, has all sorts of abilities and stuff. But people found really quick that they could overwhelm him really easily with few number of players if they had the right gear. So last year I put on a little, you know, little quirk to him that if you tried to take him with less people, his confidence would grow and he would gain more abilities and stuff, and he would even start spawning adds that were really nasty and stuff when he felt he was winning the fight or that sort of thing. So it you just kind of have to, you know, think about your intended audience when you're making these things.
They have a word that describes that. That's called evil.
Well, there is a slight bit of sadistic glee in there that, you know, you want to make sure that when you're making something that I don't mind the first time people try to take an encounter if they get, you know, totally wipes the floor with them. Because it's one of those things where it's like, I see what he was doing. Okay, let's try to attack it a different way. I like, one of the things that I like when I go to a raid or when I go to a new zone is I like trying to figure things out. I want to go in there and say, okay, I see what the mob did. Let's try to figure out what's causing that. Let's try to figure out, let's strategize on this and talk about it. That was like one of the biggest things for me in EverQuest 1 was, you know, I really loved trying to sit down and talking with, you know, our raid leader or our group leader or whatever and saying, okay, well, this is what happened. Let's try to, you know, come up with a strategy on how to counter that next time we see it. And then putting that strategy to work and defeating the boss was a great, great feeling. So I try to do that as much as I can.
Yeah, that's something I will say I've missed a little bit, it seems. And maybe it's the raid force I'm running with right now, or maybe the evolution in EverQuest 2. There would be times when we would spend back in the day, hours, days, weeks, months, on particular mobs, trying to get that encounter down, make sure that we had all 24 folks kind of on the same page and able to defeat that encounter. It seems right now there are sometimes we just roll into encounters, we can kind of almost steamroll them. I miss that trial and error discovery, and then the days and days of discussions on the forums mm-hmm. after the fact of, well, gee, what if we put this group over here or split them up like this, or what if we did this or did that? I just remember Nexona. Nexona was the mob for me. That we spent
I remember.
5 weeks on, I think. Just that one encounter.
At that time, I was playing an Inquisitor, so I needed her for my mythical. So yeah, I feel your pain on that.
But I think to some degree, as much as it's pain, it's also, to me, part of it. I don't enjoy wiping, but I enjoy wiping for a reason so that we can learn more and build sure. on it. Wiping for stupid reasons, well, they happen, but they can be aggravating, but you live with those. I do miss that challenge because I think, especially Nexona, and I think Ellie would agree too, is you get that permagrin moment when you finally do win for all your efforts.
Yeah, you get everybody cheering in Ventrilo or you know, talking in guild chat about, you know, oh my god, we finally took them, that type of stuff, yeah. It's a great feeling.
I was just thinking about all the hand-drawn maps that I've seen from the different encounters Saturday nights over at my house, getting together with friends, sort of, okay, here's how we should do that. I was thinking about this and draw a little map. And here's where we're having this.
We might actually have a little bit of a tool built into the group system that might help you guys with that a little bit, this expansion. But I'll let you guys figure it out when Velios comes out, but it should help with pointing mobs out a little easier.
Ooh, sounds interesting.
So you mentioned earlier about the Kuldane ring being back, but the other most iconic item I remember from Scars of Velius was the prayer shawl.
You might be able to find it, yes.
That didn't sound like a yes, it's back.
Yes, it's back.
And does it involve as much as the trade skilling as it did before?
Oh, it's definitely a major part of trade skilling, yes.
Ooh.
Excellent. I certainly enjoyed it in EverQuest 1. I was one of my first group of friends who found it, and I necessarily didn't tell them about it, so I was getting all these drops and saying, hey, we need to go farm snow griffin eggs. Would you come help me? And I schnookered them for a little while, and one of the other ones found out about it, so they wanted to start doing it. So then they started, you know, because back then we didn't have group updates. You right. killed one, and if you got it, you had to roll for it, and hopefully you won it. And that was one of those quests, too. You'd put all your stuff in your combine, and you'd hit the button, and you'd kind of cross your fingers and hold your breath and hope the combine succeeded.
I definitely remember that.
I was going to say I didn't play EQ1, but Dell sent me links to the prayer shawl steps involved, and wow, it looks really, really insanely long.
Yeah, it was a bit involved.
So did Domino work on that for this expansion?
Yes, she did.
As the trade skill expert, yeah. It just, that was a wonderful item, and I remember it only had like +7 stats, but I wore it. Obviously, itemization was very different back in EverQuest 1 than it is in EverQuest 2. I don't think anybody, well, maybe they might, if you work that hard at it, be running around with a +7 to wisdom shawl on right now for a shoulder slot item.
It was also a different level range then, too.
Yes, and I remember the final shawl you had to escort the fella across, I think it was Eastern Wastes at that time, and you needed a raid because you'd get ambushed. Again, that feeling of affecting the world, mobs jumping out from behind bushes and attacking you, and this guy just walking off into oblivion and trying to chase him down as you're fighting and he's moving and all that. Very exciting and very, very hectic, but very exciting at the same
time. I remember that. It was in... You had to start out on the Gnome Island or something, Iceclad, didn't you?
Yeah, maybe that was it, an Iceclad ocean.
And you had to take him all the way to the Dragon Bridge.
And he just kept on walking, like regardless that. Whether or not you were fighting or not. He kept on walking.
Kept picking more fights.
So you mentioned flying mounts a little earlier as well. Do they really, really work in every zone?
They really, really work in every zone. I have not seen an overland zone that they do not work in, and they are amazing. I've found myself, like I said before, I've found myself for hours just kind of flying in the zones and checking out the cool scenery and stuff, because it's weird, you know, when you level through common lands, for example, and you're doing quests and stuff like that, and you kind of get a layout of the land. But when you get on the flying mount and you start flying around those areas, it almost looks like a completely new area. I mean, I thought that originally, when they were, you know, first coming in, I thought they were going to make the zones feel a lot smaller, and I was really worried about that. But after it was implemented and they got them in and I actually tried it out, it actually makes the zones feel a lot bigger to me.
That would be interesting, seeing everything from a different perspective than we're used to.
Exactly. Well, I mean, cool. They work in just about every, or as far as I know, every overland. And from what I understand, they even work in a couple of dungeons.
Oh. I have to say, when I first heard about it, I think it was back at Fanfare in one of the convention rooms, I sat there going, Puckshot, there's no way they'll get this to work in every zone. You know, they've put these invisible walls up for us. We can't see over certain mountain ranges and whatnot. Nah, this will never work. So I have to say, I'm a little bit of a skeptic, but I'm excited to hear.
Believe it or not, the art guys did a wonderful job. They actually went back to every overland, and they actually put more geometry and built out the areas. Or a lot of the areas, we couldn't do them all, but a lot of the areas that would have looked bad if you'd have flown over them, they went in and filled those areas with cool-looking things and with terrain, or they, you know, stretched out the ocean view a little bit longer so that you, when you flew over the mountain, you could see the ocean, that type of stuff. And they put a lot of work and a lot of extra hours into making that look really, really good for that.
Yeah, I can only imagine, because again, my skepticism thinking, there's so much that kind of is not drawn for a reason because we weren't supposed to be able to see it, and now they're going to expose that to us. So kudos to that team for all that work to get all that stuff filled in.
Some zones needed more work than others. There was some zones like Kingdom of Sky or Otis, for example. There are giant floating islands. That wasn't really hard for us to make, you know, flyable. But stuff like Ferrot or... Butcher Block or something like that, they're built a lot differently. They weren't built with that in mind. So they definitely need a lot of work. But it's definitely cool now going up to Kingdom of Sky and getting on your flying mount and actually flying between the islands yourself and being able to control it. It's a really cool feeling.
Del, do you have, I can hear the wheels turning in your head about what's the first zone you're going to go look at when you get the flying mount?
He just said it. And it's the zone I hate Farrat. For the most. It's Farrat, absolutely.
I knew it. We were talking about that on a previous episode, all of the trees and the collision problems, and having the in-zone mounts makes it a lot easier to get around. But, wow, to be able to see it from above,
mm-hmm.
then you can see it really looks like Massachusetts.
Well,
at least it does on your map.
One thing to keep in mind, though, is that some of these zones that weren't really built for it, while they have been expanded to where you can use them in the zone, the sky line had to be pulled down a little bit to minimize on some of those things and some of the amount of work that they would have had to do. I mean, it's still pretty high. You can still fly above the tree line and stuff like that. But in some places, you might still be forced to go through certain areas with the flying than maybe flying over that really tall mountain in the middle of the map. Most places you can fly over, but there are a few exceptions where you'll actually have to fly around the mountain instead of over it, that type of thing, just because of the sheer amount that you would be able to see or you would have to render, and it would probably be a bit taxing on graphics.
Gotcha. Farrat was the zone I hated to run across to get down to Khazad Thul because there were so many twists and turns and can't get there from here.
Yeah.
Getting stuck on route. So, yes, that will probably be the very first zone that I decide to fly in.
From what I understand, most of those areas you can fly over in Farrat.
I may go down and do Khazad Thul just because I can now.
Mentor down. Go the dangerous way, Del.
No, I'm still going to do it at 90 because I don't want to die.
Needlessly? No needless dying for you?
I'm sure you'll find a way to die in there.
Actually, well, that's a great question. Can you jump off the flying mount at any point, or are you kind of saddled in?
Well, I'm sure you could cancel it. I wouldn't recommend it, but I'm sure you could try.
Okay, so it is doable. You can't jump off your flying mount and land.
I haven't tried it, but I'm sure you probably can. I don't see why you wouldn't be able to. So you can get yourself a gnomish parachute tinkered up and
ooh.
Click it off and float down. That'd be kind of neat.
You've just created a whole new class, airborne. They parachute into these dangerous situations.
Oh, we're changing the entire ranger class to be the rangers. Airborne rangers.
Oh. Oh, boy.
I'm sure I'm going to have a PM in my inbox within 5 minutes. What, you're changing the ranger class? No, I'm not. It was a joke, I swear.
The thought that comes to my mind, though, is death from above. Now, the question is, whose death will that be? Theirs when they hit the ground?
Well, knowing rangers,
you know.
I'll not answer that.
If you don't want the Wrath of Ali.
Yes, well, I find interesting ways to die all the time.
I love rangers. I really do. I love rangers. Because then they die and I don't.
Although, Ali, when we're grouped, I wouldn't really call it when you die interesting. It's usually just, you know, I wasn't paying attention.
Well, you did like that time that I backed myself off the edge of a wall.
Yes.
Where were we?
Vox.
Vox.
We were fighting the vision of Vox, and you, to get range, backed up and fell off the cliff. It was a very Wile E. Coyote moment.
Yeah. So we did a Frostfell wish list earlier this year, and one of Del's Frostfell wishes was for new types of achievements that break out of the standard pattern we've been seeing. And so we were kind of wondering if the expansion, if we will see some new achievements in Velius, and some new different types of things than we've been seeing before.
Well, I know Zelgad has been working his tail off on them. They're constantly evolving, so I'm kind of afraid that I can't really comment too much on that. I've loved what I've seen so far from me playing in beta and looking at my achievements, but I don't know enough about them to really give you details one way or the other. But I've loved everything I've seen so far.
All right. How about hidden achievements? I mean, you can't tell us if they're what they are, but can you tell us if they exist?
You were referring to, I was thinking A's, I'm sorry. Yeah. As far as achievements go, I'm not sure how many unique ones we're going to see. We've done a pretty thorough job to make sure that the ones that people expect would be there. I'm not sure if Frisnik added any extra. I'm sure he might have thrown one or two in there, but I can't tell you what they are because I haven't really looked. But I know Frisnik was working on achievements and making sure that they were all in. There might be some cleverly named ones for some of the zones that I've seen.
Alrighty. And you are a bit of a lore expert. I'm sure you've seen or heard of the red shirt guy. Have you ever been, in your history of working with EQ2, have you ever been had a red shirt guy type experience, either at fanfare or on the forums or something, where you've been outlawed by a player? And can you tell us about your experience?
Well, there's been a couple times where players would think they were outlawing. I'm not going to claim to know everything there is about lore. I don't think any of our devs know everything there is about lore. It's just too complex of a beast, you know. There are a few fans out there that know a ton of it, and I applaud them. I really do, because it's tough to know it all, or know as much as some of them do. But a lot goes into writing that lore. We typically kind of, when we go to write a new piece or to, you know, expand on a piece, we usually kind of huddle up and tackle it from a group perspective. We typically spend more time researching than we do actually writing the lore, just to make sure that we don't step on toes or you know, completely throw off something that's already been said or already been printed. But at the same time, we also kind of sit back and say, okay, well, lore is quite often a perspective thing. One creature in our game might tell the lore completely different than another creature. So a lot of times, that's where we have our biggest hang-ups is... players will sometimes see a book written in game and they'll be like, oh, that's the lore. That's exactly what happened. Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that's exactly what happened. That just might be the perception of that character. So that's usually where our hangups come from. I'm not saying we don't ever get it wrong. Sure we do. You know, everybody makes mistakes and it's, you know, tying that all together. That is the hard part.
I have this image of there being this giant library of EQ2 lore at the SOE headquarters that you go and consult. Is there any sort of encyclopedia, or is this all just in everyone's memory?
Well, we have a fairly complex list of all the lore and stuff that we've done. We also have ways of searching through the game and finding, you know, books and stuff like that have been written. But no, I mean, there's not really this huge server that just holds all of our lore. I mean, it's kind of, we have to piece it together. We do hold timelines. We have stuff like, you know, spreadsheets that show timelines of events and stuff like that, so we can make sure we get, you know, dates right and stuff. Usually, you know, it kind of falls to one guy on the team, usually holding that and saying, okay, can you look it over real quick and make sure we're not stepping on anything? Fortunately, that's not me. there's been some times where I've been asked to, hey, take a look at something, but, you know, we all do that. We all peer review our stuff, so. But for the most part, I mean, it's kind of, you know, when you're asked to write a piece or when you want to write a piece, then you typically need to do the research yourself and make sure that you're not stepping on anything. Well, there's also a lot of times, too, where fan fiction kind of plays into it. There are some times where, you know, a fan will write a really good piece of lore and it won't be canon to our story, but, you know, it's really good. And it'll get passed down and passed down and passed down. And then all of a sudden, you know, everybody's saying, well, that's the way it happened. Well, no, that's not the way it happened. That wasn't canon. You know, that wasn't something that was written by us. And I've had that happen a couple times. But, yeah, recently with Tower Frozen Shadow, there was a fan fiction piece that was made that people swore up and down was done by SOE, and it wasn't. So I tried to incorporate a little bit of it, just because it really was written well. I tried to incorporate a little bit of it when I was working on Tower Frozen Shadow, but I also tried to clear up some things that people, you know, were unsure about in the original to make sure that they got the lore right this time.
That's great to hear that player-written stories or artwork sometimes helps influence you guys and helps you drive your stories a little bit.
Oh, yeah. And it's not just in the stories. I mean, there was when it comes down to Serena, in the tower, there was a very, very well done fan art piece done. And when I was going over and talking with Art and telling him exactly what I wanted her to look like and everything like that, I actually took that piece and said, "Hey, look at this on the web. This is very close to the way I want her to look," you know. And so, I mean, you'd be surprised how much player-done things like that actually do impact the things that we do.
So back at Fanfare, there was a lot of excitement over the Othmer and whether or not they would be a playable race. So my question is a little Othmer-oriented. Othmers, are they a noble race, or are they best served with gravy?
Well, I don't feel there's any answer to that question where I won't upset half the player base, so I'm just going to plead the fifth.
Fair enough. We're going to get to see some potions of folks who kind of want to at least look like an Othmer will be able to do so.
Yes, Smokejumper actually announced that the first day of our events, celebrating Valius. Every player that logs in that day will get a Othmir Illusion potion. And Tom Toby, our animator, he's done an awesome job of just hooking up a lot of emotes. Pretty much any emote that a player can do, the Othmir can do as well, and they have their own unique animations for them. He's actually made it to where they can ride mounts, which was a lot of work. And you've heard before, when people complain about, not keeping their illusion when they go onto a mount, and it's always, it's just a tremendous amount of work. Well, Tom put the extra work into allowing people to actually ride mounts with those guys, so it's really, really cool.
Wow. I'm going to have to get on my pink unicorn.
You have a pink unicorn?
I did. I got it yesterday. I've been farming love notes.
Oh, for your Lissy Day?
Yes, that was the first thing I got. It took all day to get all my little candies and love notes.
See, now all we need, all we need is a pink Pegasus.
How many tokens will he be?
Oh, I don't know.
Because I only need 150 more, and I too will have my pink unicorn, which I'm sure folks are dying to see me riding around on.
Yes, and Dell's told me he's only getting it because it counts towards the mount achievement. But I know he's full of baloney.
He's going to use it as an appearance mount.
Absolutely. He's going right in the appearance slot. Heck, he's so cool, I may even get rid of my mount with stats just so I can use him and see and look even better. So when is the next expansion after Valios, and what will it be?
Yes.
Typical player, right? When's the next thing coming, and what can it be?
Yes.
Fair enough. But Valios, that we kind of have heard, is going to be broken up into two parts. Can you talk a little bit about that?
We kind of collectively felt that we could not do Valios justice in the amount of time that we had. So breaking it up into two parts was kind of a given toward the beginning. We knew that if we were to do the entire continent, bring in everything that people wanted to see, nostalgia-wise, and tell the story that we want to tell, and have the whole Age's End prophecy come to the forefront, and everything like that. It would just, we even working extra hours every day for the year, we would not be able to get it done and get it done right. So breaking it up into two pieces was definitely one of the things we felt from the beginning we needed to do. And that's just from a quality standpoint. We wanted to make sure it was done and done right. So that's why we broke it up.
Have you all decided on what part two will be in terms of a delivery mechanism? Will it be an expansion? Will it be a game update, a series of game updates? Or
I don't think so. That would be more in the realm of Smokejumper would know that. So I can't really answer that. Either way, I think we'll do a good job on it and make sure that it lives up to expectation as much as possible.
Anything you can tell us at all about what we might see in the second part other than snow?
You might get to see some dragons. Yeah.
Okay.
I can't go too much into it. I mean, obviously.
I had to ask.
It's one of those things where if we say something's going to happen or we say something's definitely going to be included and then we can't make it happen, then everybody comes back and it's like, well, you already promised this. And so we don't want to get people's hopes up and then not be able to deliver that. So we kind of keep it tightly wrapped until we can until we can get it nailed down on exactly what we're doing, and then I'm sure there'll be some details out there.
Well, hopefully people will be very busy and still taking everything in from part one and not have to be bothering you so much about part two.
Well, there will also be some stuff between part one and part two that will be content-wise that will come through and add to what all is available. So there are some things that we already have done that we'll be holding back a bit just for story reasons and stuff like that. You know, as the story progresses with the whole Age's End prophecy and the story for this version of Belios, as it progresses through, more and more stuff will come available and you'll be able to see it.
Great. Awesome. And finally, how about bacon or ham?
Bacon.
Thank you.
You waited Del's all that time to ask him that.
Yes, Del's answer would have been yes.
Well,
right?
I'm not a huge fan of ham, but I do like bacon, yes.
Yes, there's an ongoing argument in my guild. There have been many guild mails about bacon versus ham.
So do we want to do a little Are You Smarter Than a Delmon now?
Sure, we do. And I do have to warn you, just because we have developer here doesn't mean you get to cheat.
I don't mean to cheat, please. I dominate this game.
Okay.
Well, aren't I usually your lifeline?
Usually.
I keep getting PMs, you know, while you're recording the show asking me answers and stuff, right?
That was between you and me, okay?
Oh, I'm sorry. You can cut that part out, right? You can cut that part out, right?
Absolutely. So, Allie, what are our two categories for this week's Are You Smarter Than a Delmon question?
Well, your first category is The Eyes Have It, and your second category is Where Am I?
Ninja, what do you think?
I would go with Where Am I?
Excellent choice.
Yeah, let's try that. Where am I?
Do you want normal mode or challenge mode?
We have a red name here with us. Let's go challenge mode.
All right. I don't know how much help I'm going to be.
Well, Del, if you have to ask for help on this one, you might lose your dwarf card.
All right.
Okay, challenge mode is you have to get flawless on all three to win.
Okay.
All right, number one, this is a sort of modification of the Who Am I category that we've had in the past. You'll get the picture. Number one, here you will find, and no cheating on Ninja, no chiming in unless you're asked for help, because I know you're going to get the answer, like, after three words. Here you will find sneakies, flingers, and rammers. They seek your help in slaying a new dragon. But first, you must take part in the King's Game. Where am I?
I believe you are in the Raid Zone, Icy Keep Retribution.
Very, very well played.
Thank you.
I was going to be upset if you got that one wrong.
At first, though, I will admit I was leaning to Runny Eye the Gathering. But then the King's Court part gave it away.
I could see that. I could see it.
Number two, this is where shadowed men come from. Inside, it's Master's experiment upon the beings of Norath. They occupy the bodies of people and creatures in their quest for knowledge. The inhabitants call it the Tower of Vol. Where am I?
Are you in the zone that I hate the most?
Can you even remember the name of that zone?
It's kind of a trick question, actually.
Yeah, I got to agree with Ninja. I think this is a trick question because there are multiple obelisks, aren't there? And
you're fishy.
I am. I think I'm going to go with the original because I think I hate that zone the most, and this would be one she might use. So I'm going to say the Obelisk of Lost Souls.
Yes. That is what I had in mind. And if it was a trick question, it's because I failed at lore. Research. Yeah,
the only reason I said that is the Shadowed Men don't actually come from there, but they are there.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, then perhaps my source was incorrect.
You tell her, Ninja. You tell her.
Oh, boy. Nerve-wracking. Wait, I feel like I'm naked or in pajamas at school or something here.
Hey,
okay, number three. This place began as a humble cottage. I love this one. Built by a musician. Its rebuilding was a gift of gratitude from a dwarven mason. Before the actions of an envious brother destroyed it, its name paid homage to the goddess of peace. Where am I?
I'm going to need to phone a friend.
Hope you're not phoning me.
Yeah. Read that one more time.
Yeah, you might meet. This place began as a humble cottage built by a musician. Its rebuilding was a gift of gratitude from a dwarven mason. Before the actions of an envious brother destroyed it, its name paid homage to the goddess of peace.
Wow. Uh-oh. That's a tough one.
I have like one guess, but I almost think it's wrong. But I have like one guess. It's that house in Rivervale in the very back corner. I think there were music instruments there. It's where you start by hook or by crook. But I feel like I'm fishing at this point, and I have no idea. Is it called, like, the Overturn or something, or the Overlook?
You're up the wrong river.
Okay. Was it up the wrong river, Vale?
Maybe I twisted and turned a little too much in my hinting.
Musician. No help there. Dwarven rebuild. No help there.
What if I said, before the actions of an envious brother destroyed it and murdered its inhabitants?
The state of unrest?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, I was almost going to go there when you said murderous brother. But
yep. I said envious brother. I took out the murderous because I didn't want to give it away. I thought that would be a gimme.
But the whole musician part threw me off.
That was interesting. Still kind of wondering about the last part of that. How does that play in there?
It was originally called the State of Rest, Tranquility.
Ah,
he was paying homage to, and he was a follower of
Quellius.
Yes.
Yeah, I do remember. And I always thought that was peace and tranquility. And you said,
well, I didn't want to say tranquility because I thought that would be a gimme too.
Yeah. You snookered us.
I apologize. I think that was a gimme, and I didn't want to give it too easily because that was the third one. Boo! Well, you failed, Challenge Modell.
Do we at least get to loot the first two chests?
Sure, why not? Right. But they were just ornate crap.
Oh, ornate crap. All the good stuff that I wanted to bid on was in the third chest?
Yes, all the fabled.
All right. Well, that last question was a tough one, though.
Well, I'm glad.
So I think that's just about everything for this episode number 17 of EQ2 Talk. Is there anything else we had, Allie?
Nope, that pretty much wraps it up.
Well, we should definitely say thank you to Carlos Ninja Mora for taking time out of his very busy schedule and joining us here and having a little chat with us about Destiny of Elias.
Oh, my pleasure.
Hope you had a good time with us.
Absolutely.
We also want to say thank you to this week's corporate sponsor, Travelocity, home of the Roaming Gnome. You'll never roam alone. You can find them at Travelocity.com. If you have any suggestions, comments, or feedbacks, or want to talk about any of the things that we've been talking about here, you can reach me. I'm Delmon at EQ2Talk.com.
And I'm Allie at EQ2Talk.com.
And if you want to catch us in-game, so for me, that's EQ2.unrest.delmon, D-E-L-L-M-O-N.
And I'm at eq2.unrest.alicious, A-L-I-S-C-I-O-U-S.
And don't forget to check us out over at our Facebook page, eq2talk.com. And you can now find us by searching for us in the iTunes Music Store. Have a great week, everybody, and we will catch you next time in episode 18. And say good ninja, Allie.
Good ninja, Allie.